We're going to get to the unbelievable interview in just a moment. But first, did you know that I was a 1099 entrepreneur at age 10? That's right. When all the highly paid executives, editors, and journalists did their job, they handed the finished newspaper off to me as a 10-year-old independent contractor that could either deliver 200 newspapers to 200 homes or to two dumpsters.
I chose the 200 homes.
Since then, I've been supporting, promoting, and engaging with entrepreneurs of all ages and walks of life. One of the beautiful aspects of entrepreneurism is they're often rooted with solving a problem. It's the intuition that makes your life better. Entrepreneurs, innovators exude emotion, just like the entrepreneurs at mystore.com. Folks, check it out. Use the promo code Otis. Go to mystore.com. All season slippers as low as $25. Coconut teeth whitener, $15 with the promo code Otis. Blue Foods protein bites, they're vegan, $10.99 with the promo code Otis. All kinds of instant savings with the promo code Otis. That is my son's name, and all the proceeds go to my son's future endeavors, and maybe one day he'll have his own promo code. I wonder if he'll use Dad. Luckily, that is his choice, not mine. I chose the promo code Otis. Go to mystore.com. Go to mypillow.com. Use the 800 number, 800-598-4268. That's 800-598-4268. And don't forget to use the promo code Otis.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Explain what the National Federation for Independent Business does.
Well, NFIB was founded in 1943 as a kind of counterpoint to the
the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce.
Which was tended to be dominated by the major donors.
So right.
NFIB kind of said, we're going to represent small business, mm-hmm. and here's the deal. I'll just make up some numbers. $50 to be a member, but the most anybody can contribute is $200.
Oh, so they put a ceiling.
Exactly. So, and then they're run by a big board of independent businesses. So that way, they aren't going to be dominated by big firm money, mm-hmm. which, typically happens in a chamber. It doesn't mean it's bad. Chambers are bad. Chambers have lots of small business members. So they were founded in 1943 for that. They currently have about 350,000 member firms across the United States. They lobby on behalf of small business in Washington, D.C., of course, and in every state capital in 50 mm-hmm. states. So that's basically what NFIB does.
Quick state of the union for small business, I guess. We hear that it's the engine of the nation's economy, but every time I turn around, I see consolidation, I see duopolies that popping up left and right. Is small business okay?
Well, that does happen.
Yeah.
but it's always a dynamic. I mean, the small business sector, first of all, is the R&D for the economy.
Great.
Anybody who's got a new idea about a product or a service or how to do something better, whatever, you start it out there, and if you're right, you're rewarded with profits. That funds your growth, right? Mm-hmm. People copy you, so you get more firms.
Mm-hmm.
If you're wrong, well, you fail, and we have that all the time. But we don't lose you. We don't lose the building you're in. So if your Chinese restaurant failed, you reopen it as a French restaurant, same chef.
I get it.
But you keep using the resources until you make money, which is the signal that you're using the resources well. That's the strength of the U.S. economy. That's how we allocate resources. So it's always very dynamic. And we forget, of course, that all these big firms started off small. I mean, Microsoft started off as one person. Walmart started off as one store, right? And they did things right, and so that's what we got. But the other thing we forget about is that Walmart was not the only store trying to do this. There were a lot of firms trying to do an operating system, right? And they didn't make it, but it over years and years of all of this trying to get it done, tens of millions of people got jobs, on-the-job training, got skills. So just the dynamic of the small business sector employs tens of millions of people. If you look at it steady state-wise, small businesses, defined as those with 500 or fewer employees by the SBA, employ over half of the private sector workforce and produce half of the private sector GDP. So small business is really big business.
Small business is really big business.
Yeah. Now it's not doing very well lately, but then most of the economy is not doing so well. We are bifurcated. You know, the stock market hit a new record high today, and there are corporate profits, but those big firms are selling around the world, which our small businesses can't do. So they're doing very well. Let's say they're growing at 4%. Small business sector isn't really going anywhere, especially since it dominates the service sector, and consumer spending on services has been very, very slow. So we're not growing much at all. So let's say zero. So zero plus four divided by two is 2% growth. That's what we've had since the recovery started, 2% growth. And until we can get the small business sector back to life, hiring people so we can get the unemployment rate to fall, you know, we're going to have sluggish growth.
In your opinion, how important is the energy sector to small business?
Well, there are. It's important to small business, but to the economy. I mean, there are two kind of bright spots in the economic outlook. Housing, right? So we're coming from housing starts with only 500,000 after we were at 2.2 million. We fell all the way to 500,000. We're back. So maybe we'll do a million at an annual rate this year. So that'll create a lot of jobs that we lost back in the housing. The other is energy. Energy is an incredible bright spot. And although a lot of it is focused out here, kind of in that strip from Texas to up to the Canadian border, there are other places that have, like Western Pennsylvania and so on. So
California.
California's got, you know, if they can just get out of their own way,
develop
these resources. So it's going to be really wonderful. And so right now, lots of jobs could be created if we get the Keystone approval. Obviously, you know, moving the energy is really important, the raw material. So we can easily become energy independent in a decade or so. That doesn't mean energy is cheap. It means that we would just be buying most of what we use, oil, gas, whatever, coal, right here in North America. And that would be really cool.
What does that mean to be energy independent in a global economy?
Well, what it means is that you're buying everything here. It's independent. Didn't say cheap, right? And the natural gas thing is a great example. Natural gas in the United States sells for about $3 an MCF, but in Europe it's 13. Now look at oil. The price of oil, a barrel of oil, is the same kind of everywhere. Well, the difference is everybody can export and import oil. So all the producers can export and people can buy it. We can't do that with our natural gas. We don't have any way to export it. So you can understand that over the next 10 years, there'll be a lot of money to be made, and we should do this in learning and getting set up to export this natural gas to customers around the world. Their price will come down, our price will come up, and natural gas in a decade, say, will be like oil, kind of the same price everywhere. That's what you have in a big competitive market. And the process of doing that, of course, is going to be wonderful for the U.S. economy, and particularly, you know, states that have all of this energy to be developed.
North Dakota being one of them.
North Dakota is wonderful. You know?
I wanted to ask you about the gas before we get into oil. Natural gas. Ken DeCubellis, he's a CEO of Blackridge Oil and Gas. He was a former Exxon executive. Told me that the petrochemical industry is putting $20-30 billion into importing, exporting refineries, something like that. That's what you're talking about here.
That's right.
What do you make of that as far as the amount of money, the amount of investment? Is that going to bring natural gas to the oil, gold, silver, where it's a universal price?
I think so. I think, you know, again, we just have to have a free market where it's traded. Right now, lots of people would love to have our cheap natural gas, but we can't get it to them. So just internally in the economy, we have to build the delivery system, the pipelines and so on to get that done. We also have to change our technologies for cars and vehicles in the sense to, you know, and then get gas stations where you can get natural gas, not gas, right? All of that is, and of course, that's wonderful for jobs and growth and so on. In the meantime, companies that really use petrochemicals want this and can't get it, so they're going to come to us. So if you look at the building that's going to go on over the next 10 years of new companies here that make stuff that uses petrochemical, particularly natural gas, fertilizers, all these kinds of things, that's going to bring a lot of new companies here to the U.S. And again, that's going to contribute to job growth and growth in our GDP, and that's really good news. Especially for North Dakota. But North Dakota is going to you know, see some of those plants, but they're really going to get it out and then send it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so we a lot of work and jobs will be in putting those pipelines in place.
The gold rush back in, I forget the year, in South Dakota, they say the people who sold shovels made the money.
Exactly.
You work with a lot of independent and small businesses. Historically, oil booms are going to produce shovel salesmen, whatever the shovel might be. Are there any businesses that historically stand out, like the shovel business, with an oil boom, whether it be natural gas or energy? You know what I mean?
To where small business
thrives in a boom.
Yeah. Well, most of it is more of the same. That is, if you go to North Dakota, where you find they're short on housing, short on places, you know, motels and hotels, short on restaurants, short on barbershops. I don't know if
service.
Those guys get haircuts. Right.
Yeah.
The sector that small business is really good at. I mean, we build most of the houses and we cut hair. We do. So it's really more of the same that you have to have. Now, there's some specializations. Like you have a large number of guys who've made a lot of money carrying water used for fracking, you know. So there's some specialized businesses that you'd have a lot more water carriers in North Dakota
right.
than you would have in most states. So some
sand
of the specialized, right, but most of it is, you know, pretty much just more of the kind of fundamental support services that that any collection of people have mm-hmm. to have.
So the I see what you mean, because it depends on the technology that goes into it,
right? And yeah. So
okay. Former Governor Ed Schaefer calls the Bakken a technology boom as opposed to an oil boom. What do you make of that statement?
Well, you know, it is a technology boom, and then first of all, doing all of this with the fracking and all, I mean, that's been a big technological development. It's been around for a while, but it's really been refined. The second thing, of course, is that once there's money in it, this is the way markets solve problems. Technological advance moves much faster because there's a payoff to solving problems. So markets don't solve problems until they're worth solving. And this one is, you know, those kinds of issues are now worth solving. So finding out how to get the gas and the oil and everything out cheaper, better, with less damage to the environment, those all have big payoffs. And so it is a technology. And it's driven by, of course, the energy requirements of a growing country and a growing world.
Okay. So I got two more here. I'm trying to remember what this next one was going to be, because I'm going ahead here. What was the one? Oh, I got it. Okay. Price of oil. Between your readings, your colleagues, or if you go to a psychic reader, they say that if the price of oil reaches a certain amount, the oil activity stops. One of two things that could upset the boom, the EPA and the price of oil. Have you heard from anybody about the price of oil as far as what that sweet number might be, or a range to where, say, investors should probably talk with their other investors?
Yeah, well, that's, of course, a hard call. I mean, and again, yeah. It depends on your perspective. From the consumer's perspective, the lower the price, the better.
The better.
All right, so that's really nice, because then they can use lots of oil and oil-based products. On the other hand, from the producer's side, the lower the price, the less I can produce, because there's a cost of getting a barrel out of mm-hmm. the ground, and I got all the Jed Clampett oil a long time ago. That was the really cheap stuff, you know. So now it's very expensive. Now I have to drill down 10 miles and blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah. So if prices get too low, then of course we can't effectively produce it without making, you have to be able to make a profit here. So that's really the balance, and you really have to let markets kind of sort that out. Now, if you get rules put on top of that, like the EPA, you know, which says, you know, you have to, fracking water has to be returned to the river in a pure state. And we've got some regulations, by the way, where cities have to put water in back into a river cleaner than they took it out.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
So you can get these kinds of regulations. So those kinds of regulations raise the cost
mm-hmm.
And therefore reduce the supply. That
slows down the process,
slows
too.
Slows it down, right. That's reducing the supply, job growth will be slower, et cetera. So that's the balance that we have. And, you know, in some people's view, of course, we've got a bunch of people, you know, writing these regs who have never had a job in the private sector and don't have a clue.
Yeah.
We had 100 or so of those try to rewrite, restructure 15% of GDP called the healthcare industry, and look what that's doing. And we could have the same kinds of problems in the energy side. You know, we So we have to be very careful about that. And so
I'm not sure we have enough tape for the healthcare small business conversation.
No, we're not going to go there. We won't go there.
That's a good point.
It's just a kind of an example of, you know, the people who are writing these regulations are, I'm sure they want good things to happen, but they don't have any kind of the experience that they should have, an understanding of how private sector works, so that the regulations they write will often be very counterproductive. Very expensive.
Final question. Advice for potential investors, whether it's a 24-year-old driving out to the Bakken oil boom to make his first million or a 65-year-old seasoned veteran looking at getting back in the game, any advice you might have for somebody entering an energy sector like that?
Be careful.
I think that's good, by the way. Just be careful.
Don't light a match. It's very volatile stuff. Of course, there are two ways to invest in it. One is to actually go there and start a water carrying business, or go there and build an apartment building to rent out, or go there and build a motel or a rest or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because that's one way to invest in it. And of course, you're taking a risk because this is a long-term investment. The building's going to be here a long time. You're counting on, you have to think about how long will this last. Now, just as a simple example, there's a lot of work that goes into drilling a gas well, but once it's capped, there's not a whole lot there, right? So you have to think very carefully about not just this year and next year, but you know, what's going on in the future. In terms of being an investor, like, you know, buying stocks and, you know, shares in a company, the demand for energy is just going to go on forever. So if you want to be if you think energy is going to be good, in the long run, then you should, you know, think about investing in an exchange-traded fund like XLE, mm-hmm. Which just puts lots of these companies in there for you. You don't have to worry about idiosyncratic risk, which is kind of like a Martha Stewart problem. Good company, but the stock crashes because she did something stupid, and that's idiosyncratic. You don't need that, so you want a whole bunch of them. So you strategically invest in healthcare or in energy, and use that kind of an approach to get in. But in both cases, you really have to think about longer about the future. And it's just that if you go out there and start a water transportation company, it's harder to get out of it once things change than to call up your broker and say, sell my XLE.
Bill Dogelberg, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Did you know that I was a 1099 entrepreneur at age 10? That's right. When all the highly paid executives, editors, and journalists did their job, they handed the finished newspaper off to me as a 10-year-old independent contractor that could either deliver 200 newspapers to 200 homes or to two dumpsters.
I chose the 200 homes.
Since then, I've been supporting, promoting, and engaging with entrepreneurs of all ages and walks of life. One of the beautiful aspects of entrepreneurism is they're often rooted with solving a problem. It's the intuition that makes your life better. Entrepreneurs, innovators exude emotion, just like the entrepreneurs at mystore.com. Folks, check it out. Use the promo code Otis. Go to mystore.com. All season slippers as low as $25. Coconut teeth whitener, $15 with the promo code Otis. Blue Foods protein bites, they're vegan, $10.99 with the promo code Otis. All kinds of instant savings with the promo code Otis. That is my son's name, and all the proceeds go to my son's future endeavors, and maybe one day he'll have his own promo code. I wonder if he'll use Dad. Luckily, that is his choice, not mine. I chose the promo code Otis. Go to mystore.com. Go to mypillow.com. Use the 800 number, 800-598-4268. That's 800-598-4268. And don't forget to use the promo code Otis.